Okay, well, I see from the schedule that we're only, 45 minutes or an hour off schedule. But I think we're doing good. And I think we will accomplish what we set out to accomplish starting this morning. So I'm not too concerned. And if we never got to the Night of Spirit, it's like Father Thomas Keating said, most of us aren't going to arrive there in this lifetime anyway. So we could wish each other good luck and be on our way. However, I'm going to read something from my book that's Falling Apart, When Gods Die. And both John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila say that there are two parts of the soul. So I will read what John has to say about that. He said the soul has a psychological structure which has two major components, the sensory and the spiritual. Each component of the sensory and the spiritual has specific faculties, our powers. And we talked about the senses and the sensory part of us this morning. The sensory part of the soul, sometimes referred to as the lower part of the soul, and sometimes as the external part of the soul, consists of the powers of external and internal senses. The external senses are sight, hearing, smell, taste, and touch, as we know. The world comes to us through the external senses. Our interior senses are imagination, fantasy, and sense memory. John does not distinguish among them, but in general, they appear to be the recipients of the impressions of external things, external images, and we know that, making the world present within the individual and available to the spiritual faculties. They are conjuring up, as we talked about this morning, they are capable of conjuring up their own images as well. So he speaks of the desire of the sensory faculties to obtain and gain fulfillment. He refers to the interior sense as an archive or a receptacle for image and forms. And he says it functions as a mirror presenting this material to the spiritual senses. Does that make sense? I'm in When Gods Die, page 55, 56. Now, I think there is perhaps a newer...
I have
that. Okay, all right. The spiritual part of the soul, sometimes referred to as the upper, and I've heard it called the higher self, that kind of thing, and depends on different traditions, consists of powers of intellect, will, and memory. These are the faculties which enable a person to know, to love, to choose, and to envision. The intellect refers to the ability to understand, to comprehend, and to make meaning. It draws its data from the internal senses. John describes the imagination and fantasy as the gate and entry to the soul. He continues, here the intellect comes as though to a seaport or market to buy and sell provisions. The memory, as you and I know, is closely linked with fantasy. We may have a memory, but oftentimes memories are enhanced. And if you ask two people to relate their memory of one circumstance, event, or object, you will get two different impressions and versions. It is a storehouse of the past, as we know, but a source for envisioning possible futures. Purified, it is the seat of hope. And in terms of memory, you know, in the spiral staircase that Father Thomas tells us that as we age, that we make that descent and we tend to cast off that which we don't any longer need or relate to. Or even painful memories, we tend to, in elder age, to finally let go and cast out. And I remember walking that journey with my elderly mother before she passed away 2.5 years ago, and we buried her on her 94th birthday. But I remember we'd be riding in the car, and it was like she would be talking to me, but it's like she would be talking to an old friend. And she would say, "Well, you remember so-and-so, and that time that, you know," and I could see, and I would have to remind her, you know, she would say, "Well, in 1937, I would have to say, "Well, Mother, I wasn't born in 1930. Oh, okay, yes, she sort of remembered that. So I could see her putting aside the things that no longer had value, but really embracing the things that she remembered that really did have value and that she wanted to take with her. So it was. I could understand what Father Thomas was trying to say, and I think we do have a tendency to do that, and I think our way of doing that is perhaps more accelerated because we are consciously asking to be relieved and collaborating with the Spirit in casting out those things that really have no value, those painful memories that may have plagued you for years. So anyway, both Teresa and John spend a lot of time talking to us about memory, will, and intellect. John generally follows the anthropology of St. Thomas Aquinas, who acknowledges only intellect and will as spiritual faculties. In including memory among the spiritual faculties, John appears to be following Saint Augustine. However, in John's use, at times memory seems to be connected to fantasy, and we know that it is before it's purified, and at times it appears to be a part of the intellect. The addition of memory as a distinct spiritual faculty may be quite practical, since it allows John to relate the three theological virtues of faith, hope, and love to the three spiritual faculties of intellect, memory, and will. The will is the final arbiter and governor of the whole personality. It is inclined to the good as the good is comprehended by intellect. What is good? What is not good? The will has to contend with the appetites and passions and emotional programs. Okay? And then he goes on to talk about the soul's relationship with God, and he said the spiritual part of the soul is the realm where a relationship with God is established. And here God is known and loved. And that's why the spiritual journey to us sometimes seems so nebulous, because we don't know where the spiritual part of our soul is. We haven't even begun often to think of ourselves or others as soul. So I was thinking about this in terms of centering prayer groups and being a facilitator, being a member of a prayer group. And we do a presentation on soul friending in the context of prayer groups, and some of you may have heard that presentation, and I know that Nestor is able to give that presentation now. And I've often thought soul friending, and this was near and dear to Father Thomas, and the presentation takes the most important points that Thomas makes in a series of articles he did in the Contemplative Outreach newsletter, I think in the year 2000, and he wrote, I think the newsletter, maybe two or three issues of it. And so we have taken, as I said, the most important points and put into the context of a presentation, and we offer that information for facilitators or just for any group who wants to hear it. But I was thinking, too, about the idea of soul friending. It was Thomas's hope, and still is, that centering prayer groups would come to that level of relationship among the centering prayer members where soul friending, the dynamic of soul friending, is taking place within the context of the group. And it was his hope, because he knows how difficult it is to find a spiritual director in the contemplative dimension, that this would serve as spiritual direction to one another. So in retrospect now, you know, if we could, in our prayer groups or any activity or environment in our life, begin to think of one another as souls. And in our relationships, we are soul friending, or my soul making friends with the soul of another. And I think that's the first step in being able to really see God in the other person, or Christ in the other person. So I thought that was kind of interesting, and I think it really has to do with this movement into the dark nights and understanding that. Any questions? Anything you'd like to comment about? Yes.
In going over these spiritual faculties,
yes.
Father Menninger, in his book, The Loving Search for God,
yes.
uses those four faculties
yes.
when he's describing our mind in centering prayer. And he uses the four ladies
yes.
as Miss Will, Miss Intellect, Miss Memory, Miss Understanding.
Yes.
Personalities.
Personality.
But the thing is, that comes from the cloud of unknowing in the 14th century.
Yes.
That describes an intimate relationship with God.
Yes.
So it's interesting that it's come forward with John of the Cross. And
right. And I think we have to assume John of the Cross knows of the cloud of unknowing and was deeply touched by it. But we don't know really to the degree of access they had in terms of women did not enter theological schools. They had no vehicle for understanding theology as John did. But John did a lot of teaching, too, and so did Teresa. And Teresa had wonderful spiritual directors that helped her along the way in understanding. So I can see where both of those would speak of that, and that they were very important on the journey. And the crux of the idea is that those faculties are purified and raised to higher self, or that level of soul. Does that make sense? And I wish we had time. I think we mentioned that a little bit in here, but I wish we had time to go more into that. But in the book, When Gods Die, and certainly in the collective works, and in the interior castle, John and Teresa, if you're interested, talk a lot in detail about the purification of the memory, the intellect, and the will. Okay, thank you for that. Interestingly enough, Teresa in the sixth mansion, which is the mansion of the betrothal, and using a more contemporary term, the engagement period, the engagement to be married before the spiritual marriage takes place and is consummated. And she said, makes a startling statement, I think, in chapter in the sixth mansion. It's the longest chapter in the interior castle. It consists of 11 chapters. And she said, this is the place where soul becomes spirit. Interesting. And she said, it is a natural progression as Christ is spirit. And so we are made in the image of God. So moving in to the night of spirit, let's just take a look at this. The purpose is threefold. It releases one from thinking the spiritual journey is primarily for self. Now, as we mature on the journey, we understand that God has a plan for each one of us, and our journey impacts not only us, but certainly everyone around us and potentially the whole world. So it is transpersonal. One begins to search for God in relationship, but in moving that dynamic push that the Spirit gives us to service expands our journey to God's greater purpose or His perfect plan for each one of us. It is also the attempt, it's not the attempt, it is the major push that God is making in us to make God the center. I kind of think of making God the center of our being. You know, in Lent, we are striving to make small sacrifices and fast and observe Lent and that kind of thing. And I think I've always thought about Lent as the dethroning process. And I have had the opportunity to do a couple of retreats and lead a couple of retreats in Lent. And so we kind of go through a mental process, sort of like a little guided meditation in the dethroning of our personal self from the center of our being. And so I would ask the participants to just reflect for a moment, go inside, and if I ask you who is sitting on the throne in the center of your being, what do you think most of us say? I need to come to this group more often. Usually, the revelation is that, darn, I'm sitting on the throne of the center of my being because the world is revolving around me and I'm involved in this and I'm involved in that and I have, life is so busy and I have so many objectives and I'm the center of my own personal universe. So the realization of that, that's another awareness. And so Lent, I often think of as the dethroning process and the imploring to God to take God's rightful place on the throne in the center of our being. And that's asking a lot. That's asking a lot. We have to ask ourselves, do we really want to get off the throne? So it's making God the center. The detachment, going back to the ascent to Mount Carmel, that nada, that no thing, detachment of those things in us that is not of God in terms of the dark nights. And John certainly enjoyed relationships and enjoyed his life and loved God, loved what he was doing, loved people. It's not like he's saying we have to live an austere, self-contained and isolated life. He did not do that, and certainly Teresa did not do that. Teresa loved people. She had a wonderful relationship with both men and women, and so did John. She really appreciated the male expression, and John really appreciated the feminine expression. So it's another critical threshold. We come to this place again where God is saying, wait, there's more. And we may think that we have arrived somewhat in the embrace of God. And look at all the books we've read. Look how long we've been studying. Look how long we've been praying. Look how long and how much our faith has evolved. And look at all of the things that we have done in the spirit of servant leadership and service. And we just kind of feel like this is the best I can do in this life. But a new threshold, as we said, and this is kind of reiterating what I said this morning about thresholds, is distinguishable from the stage which preceded it, and now we come to another doorway. And it denotes a turning point, launching us into a deeper stage of faith, hope, and love. The three major initiations. We've talked about the first stage, the wound of love, the second stage that comes toward the end of that honeymoon stage is the wound of interpersonal love, where we begin not only to understand our own personal woundedness, but the woundedness of humanity and of the world. I think this is a delicate place too, and I think sometimes it hurts because the pain that we are feeling for the love and the woundedness of the world, I think at a certain point in time on the journey, we begin to experience the suffering of Christ and the world. In other words, as human will is gradually being aligned with divine will, There's no magic wand that all of a sudden we are experiencing and know the will of God. All through the journey, our human will is gradually being aligned with the will of God. And it is natural that we would experience the joy and the love of God, of Christ, moving through us now, reaching out to others, but also the suffering of Christ. And the third stage, which we're moving into now, is the wound of consuming love. And each of these stages involves another conversion experience, known or unknown to us. How many of you feel that you have ever experienced some kind of conversion? And sometimes we have an extraordinary conversion experience where it really shakes us to the core and wakes us up and we make a new commitment. And sometimes people are going through conversion experience and don't have any overt knowledge of it. We're always going through a conversion experience. It's ongoing. So each stage that we move through in life involves a personal conversion. Every time we sit down in that chair for centering prayer is a conversion experience. So, yes.
Question.
Yes.
These stages that you just mentioned, would we relate to those? You know, first there's another, you know, discovering that there is another, wanting to enter into relationship with the other, and then finally finding out that there is no other. Is that what the consuming love would be related to?
I think that you can read more about that in the collected works and come to your own conclusion about that. To me, the word wounded as John uses it, is saying that I'm aware of that I am separate from God. Even though we are in this age, an amazing work is being done in guiding us and the Spirit leading us back to that non-dual feeling of separation from God. But I think that's a wound, that's a major wound in humanity, and accounts for some of the things, many of the things that we see in the world. So, but again, first I relate it to myself, and then the transpersonal is that, wow, it's not just about me, but I see the Spirit working, you know, what is happening in the whole world and other people. I see that the divine therapy and those wounds are beginning to be healed with all of the people who are seeking the principle of the divine indwelling. How many of you were raised without knowing that God is living within you? That is the number one obstacle and difficulty that people have with the contemplative dimension. If we cannot grasp the fact that there is a dynamic living presence alive within us that we can be in relationship with in this lifetime, centering prayer or other forms of contemplative prayer meditation go nowhere. If I don't believe that that life lives within me, and I sit down in the chair and close my eyes and recollect all of my faculties and move within, but if I have not heard that, grasped it, or believe it, what's there? What do you find? We just meet ourselves coming and going. This is huge. Yes?
Is that like the divine spark that the Gnostics talked about?
Sure. Sure. It is the presence of God within us. And John experienced that in essence of a living flame. Of a flame, a dynamic presence in that flame that is alive and active within us. It's real. It's not a metaphor. Yes?
It's in everything. It's in this, it's in that, in nature, in everything.
Yes.
So,
yes.
How can you be wounded? For if what is God is the I am, we are all part of that I am, cosmically.
Yes, but you know that now. There are millions of people that don't know that.
Those are the words that we were raised with.
I wasn't raised with those words.
They say it in the scriptures and in mass and in saint when they say, this is my body, this is...
Yes. I understand that you understand that, but not everyone does.
I don't understand anything. It has to
be. I understand that you heard that. And that's a wonderful thing. Yes. And then just today, a couple of people have shared with me the second greatest obstacle. I am not worthy to be loved by God. Oh, I love it. We have to have one in every group. I love it. This is great. I think you are a gift to this group. And many of us just not have come the way that you came, or heard it the way that you heard it, or embraced it in early childhood or adolescence or even early adulthood. We're on the path that you are already on. And we're hearing it sometimes for the first time.
But I think that's something that we got because the priest is the man, and I'm sorry because I love him. The priest and the deacon, were the man, and we women absorb that since little. You know, they always are first. We always do for them. We all... You know? And then that's why we're not identifying like we are. But if we carve, we have the same or better than them because we brought Jesus into the world.
I said, preach it, sister.
That's wonderful. You have a wonderful theology. Thank you. Thank you for that. I love that. Oh, I anything goes in these conversations. Trust me, I don't have the final word, or I don't have it together. So I depend on you, and I love when you share your stories like that. Thank you so much. Please don't feel shy about doing that. Yes.
I consider being learning in contemplative prayer, as you had to say, that God lived within me and never left, the greatest gift of this prayer. I consider the learning in this prayer, I think, that that God lives within me and has never left, always was there, always will be there, is the greatest gift that I've ever received. And and not too many years ago, I shouldn't even say this, but it's a safe group, right? It's kind of like going to confession. There was a young priest who was with the other priests and going to hear confessions, and so my husband, for the first time, had said to me, I think I'll go to a contemplative service, I mean a service with you. Penance service. I said, okay, we're on our way to go eat. Well, but you know, this young priest was allowed to give the sermon, and he said, first thing he said was, we all know that when we sin, God leaves us. Oh. True. And I looked at my husband and I said, that's not true. This wasn't that many years ago.
Yes.
So anyway, but it's still out there.
And yes.
And so, yes. I don't know how to turn this off.
I should. Thank you. No, I appreciate that. Yes, Paul?
I was going to say, my understanding, the way I was taught about baptism is God makes his home in us. And the reason baptism is never repeated is because God never leaves. You know, it's a permanent, we used to say a permanent mark on the soul. God never abandons us. We're the one who leave if anybody does.
Yes. Okay. Yes, Rosemary.
The one thing that strikes me all the time is that Mass, we've said, Lord, I am not worthy. I don't say it personally, but I mean, that's what the priest says.
You mean you don't say it personally? You just let the priest say it for all of us and hopes it takes.
I say something else.
Okay.
And this was,
oh, gosh. Sally?
Yeah. I just, this is what, right now on my app for centering prayer, I have one of the guidelines when I finish, and it's a guideline number 2 from Open Heart, Open Mind. And it says, our basic core of goodness is our true self. Its center of gravity is God. The acceptance of our basic goodness is a quantum leap in the spiritual journey. And I've found that introducing people to centering prayer, well, my personal experience, I had that quantum leap through centering prayer. That I have basic goodness, but it was amazing how ingrained that thought of sinner, and it's not just, it's in all faiths. And I've introduced centering prayer to some people, and they've made a beginning. And this was the stumbling block. They're like, well, what do you mean? They couldn't get over this, that they have something in them that is good, and that at the core is good. And they're afraid of that, their own divinity, in a sense, or that part of them that is connected to the divine, because it's so ingrained that they're sinners.
Yes. Yeah, I had an experience in Bismarck, North Dakota, just a very few years ago, where I was offering an introductory workshop on centering prayer, and I came across that phrase that, and acknowledged our basic core of goodness. And there was a woman that stood up, and she was so angry. And she advised us that none of us have any facsimile of a basic core of goodness, that we are bona fide sinners and we always will be. And, you know, I tried to offer some consoling words, and there were 80 people there, so it was very disruptive because she was really into an emotional program. And to make her point, and that we could all leave there knowing how bad off we really are. And nothing I could say was going to change her attitude that she was projecting on the whole group. And I felt very sad for the experience, but I felt really sad for her to go through life thinking that there is no part of her that is good that God acknowledges. And we just have to let go. But thank you. I think there are a lot of people out there like that, Sally, too. Okay, yes.
Just to the other side of that coin, I work with adults preparing them for baptism, and in the Catholic Church that takes a year. And they come to us because they've touched that spark inside of them. And they want to get to know, they want to enter that relationship. So, you know, I have them doing Lectio Divina right now as their mystagogia. So it's just, I feel like I'm very blessed. And it's helped me along my spiritual journey tremendously because these people are, they know they have it. So, you know, we're just fanning the flames. So it's there's both sides of the coin.
Yes. But we also have to look at the people now, particularly in our culture and time now, that are not baptized and are not raising or choosing not to baptize their children in a traditional tradition, and are leaving it up to the children to grow into adulthood or adolescence and make their own choices. So. And I think we really don't even have time to go there right now. But I think that's something that we have to think about.
We just had a gentleman who had his exact experience, and he was angry at his mother for not having him baptized until I said, have you talked to her? And he finally talked to her, and she said, you're doing exactly what I always wanted. I wanted it to be your choice. So...
Thank you. Okay. So we tend to think, excuse me, of that there are two nights of spirit, the dark nights, two dark nights, the night of sense and the night of spirit. In reality, there is only one with four parts. So the four nights that the soul passes through are four stages. Is the active night, what John calls the active night of sense, but the passive night, and the active night of spirit, and passive night of spirit. And I have no idea how that comma got in there, but nevertheless, it doesn't mean a thing. So what does that mean, active night and passive night? Oh, it simply means that the active night is what we do to help ourselves along on the journey. What can we do? What can we do? And you know what we've done. We've read books. We've sought out community. We have listened to others. We have studied. We have gone on retreats. We have experienced immersion experiences. We have surrendered in as much as we can. Teresa, again, going back to her, says that the human being can do no more after the third mansion. So between the third and fourth mansion is a critical axial shift. There is nothing else that we can do to move our spiritual journey along or effect the spiritual journey in our own life. So John tells us that there are faults of beginners on the journey, and I am not going to read through the list. I'm going to let you look through that. And what stands out to you? What would you like to speak to? How many of them can we identify with? Okay, greed for books, pictures, and holy objects, all right? I heard that. Yes, okay. What's our motivation? We have no idea when we first start, and Sally said over attachment to spiritual persons. Yes?
Anger over other sins.
Anger over other sins. Not our own, of course, yes. But anger over other sins. Who is it? Richard Rohr said in one of his daily meditations that we would be so let down if we discovered that there in reality is no hell. Because we certainly wanted it for all of those people who have given us the hard way. I love that. You would think there would be so much joy, but darn.
Believing that we know the best way to God, because after all, we do every prayer.
That's a big one. Thank you. Believing that we know the best way. The best way to do the spiritual journey. And I had a dear neighbor at one time, and I was planting flowers out in the yard one spring, and she was on her front porch, and she said, "Susan," she said, "why are you planting flowers?" And I said, "well, you know, I'll plant flowers every spring. I love flowers." And she said, "the end of the world." She said, "the end is coming." And I said, "well, how do you know that?" She said, "I'm in the truth. I'm in the truth." And okay, I said, "well, you know, I'm going to go ahead and plant these flowers, and if it's the last spring of my life, I'm really going to enjoy them." Well, the end didn't come. I think that was in 1982, best I remember. But it may someday. But, you know, and that was a good learning experience for me. What a dear person she is. But sometimes we do the same thing. And I would love for everyone in my family and my husband's family to do centering prayer. But and a couple have come to a presentation that I have done on centering prayer and other. And their assessment was that they didn't understand a word I said. Okay. All right. So anything else you'd like to say about the faults of beginners? Yes.
Can you comment on overdue spiritual practices and neglect business of ordinary life?
She asked if I would talk about, well, it's when the quest for the spiritual journey, or when we are in our avid seeker honeymoon stage, where we go here and there and we do this and that and may be forgetting about family or friends, our duties, that kind of thing. And I know I've heard that scenario from some of my former charismatic friends that, you know, we're out every evening at this or that. And I've heard Thomas talk about that a little bit too. So it's we are become avid spiritual seekers, but we have to keep life in balance. And I think that's really what it's talking about, is keeping life in balance and not neglecting the things that we have to do with family, that kind of thing. Yes, you have something on your mind. You are good. Okay. All right. Okay. Oh, I see. All right. We have a continuation. and we believe that we know the best way to God, right? And sometimes we are still caught in the trap of, not your will, O Lord, but my will be done, according to my word. Okay? So John cautions us about the faults of beginners, and to me, it's just the normal, everyday stuff of the false self that we become aware of and strive to dismantle. One of the things, too, when we move into, when we have consented to this axial shift, and we may be at this critical threshold for a long time, we may never move to the night of spirit. I think that the night of spirit generally would happen right in terms of, and may be, the axial shift and the threshold that catapults us. What is happening is that we are being invited now to jump off the cliff. If you remember the illustration of the ascent to Mount Carmel, so we are asked, and maybe we're getting to the top of that spiritual mountain, are making progress, but it seems as though in the night of spirit that we are being asked to jump off the mountain into the cloud of unknowing. And so everything along the way has been shifting, concepts of God, removing obstacles. We are getting better and better. We have let go. We have done an enormous amount of wonderful work. But wait, there's more. And so it's like being cast into the cloud of unknowing and unknowing everything that we thought we knew. Remember that fourth stanza that I wrote or read last night at the end of last night's little presentation on the unknowable. And for those of you who weren't here last night, I'll close today's presentation with that again because it is so profound. It was written at the end of John's journey, and it really illumines where John was at the end of his life in his relationship with God. It also, the night of spirit, deals with the residual stuff of the unconscious. Well, first of all, the residual stuff, sort of the leftovers from the night of sense that have not been reconciled. Okay, we'll talk about that in just a moment. So, as we said before, the night of sense is not a magic wand that makes everything disappear, all of our faults and all of our human error and disappear. There are sometimes leftovers that present themselves then in the night of spirit. But the night of spirit, according to Thomas Keating, really deals with the unconscious and the emergence of the knowing of the unconscious, or the realization, awareness of some of the repressed material in the unconscious. So the night of spirit is different from the night of sense in that this is primarily a total interior experience. In other words, there are no external trials going on in life. A person may look totally normal, nothing much going on externally in life, no life crises, no major family crises. But this trial, this night of spirit, is strictly deeply, deeply interior. Now, a lot of people ask about depression. And I'm sorry this is so discombobulated, but that happens with a flash drive on someone else's computer, and we hope to avoid that, but anyway. There's a wonderful book that differentiates depression from the Night of Spirit, and that's, I've read several, but the best one is by Gerald May. There's one by Thomas More. Some people know Thomas More, but I will really tell you that Gerald May's is excellent. And we don't have time to really go into what Gerald May says, but it gives a wonderful differentiation, and it's very important because some people, yes?
What is the title of that book by Gerald May?
I think it's just entitled The Dark Night. Pardon? Okay. So this gives you just a little bit of a sense of the dark night in terms of our depression, what depression is, and what the dark night is. What I really would like to focus on, though, is the 10 steps of the hidden ladder of love, and I think that all of you have a handout on that. And so we kind of go back to faith again for a few minutes. And even though John and Teresa both experienced exuberant mystical experiences, John said that they are just a signpost along the way. Spiritual experience is not the goal. And even if one has a supernatural, exuberant, mystical experience, it is only a soft ray of what God is in reality. It is not the totality of the reality of God. So when there is a signpost, we don't linger and remain with the signpost if we have a destination, but we acknowledge the signpost and we move on. Despite John's exuberant mystical experience, his advice to us, if one experiences it, to let it go. And don't make the rest of your spiritual life for the rest of your life centered on that one or two spiritual experiences. It's a signpost along the way. If one does linger with the signpost, you have the danger of having more baggage to unload. For people who really sit on the signpost with spiritual experience for a long time and wait for the next one to come their way, may develop a certain spiritual pride, which is a heck of a lot of excess baggage to unload. And one little story about that, very briefly, I was in the UK about maybe 10 years ago, and Father Thomas was there too. He was giving a keynote presentation, and he was speaking about this very thing, about mystical experience and the signpost along the way. And just like the woman in Bismarck, North Dakota, there was a woman who became very irate and accused him of trying to take away the mystical gift that God had given to her. And it was obvious, and so he, with his compassion and usual generosity, tried to explain John's of the Cross's and Teresa's take on that, as well as his own. But she wasn't buying into it, and at one point in time, I thought she was going to come out of her chair and step up on that platform and punch Thomas in the nose. She was so angry, so angry. And In spiritual direction, I think you have to be very careful with people who are and or have had a spiritual experience like that, because we have a tendency to want to hold it close for the rest of our life, not let go of it, feel that we are the special ones of God, that we've been blessed in some unique way, and that we are unique, and we don't want anyone to take that away from us. So I know that the woman felt that Thomas was taking a gift away from her, and it really pushed her buttons. So anyway, but John says, despite his experience, that the preferred path to God, by God, is by the hidden ladder of faith, and then the hidden ladder of love. And that ladder and the faith is hidden. Then he goes on to tell us that there are 10 basic steps to the hidden ladder of love. And it is that faith development and deepening relationship with God with all the lights and fireworks. He said it is a process of descending and ascending, and we've talked about that. A process of being humbled and being exalted in God simultaneously. A journey from believing to knowing, which we've talked about. And perfection, along with Teresa's teaching, comes with knowledge of self and knowledge of God. And the soul will alternate between the two, such as Jacob's vision. Now, in this diagram or illustration, it starts off by looking like the spiritual journey is a linear process, and you and I know from our own lived experience that it is not, and that we go back and forth, and we gain a little, and we regress, and then we are fortified, aided by grace, and we keep growing. So the ladder is like that too, and scripturally, he relates it to Jacob's vision, and the soul alternates between the two of knowledge of self and knowledge of God. And Teresa will say that knowledge of God does not come without knowledge of self. Okay. So I love to ask people, what image did you have? As we talked early on in that first stage when we were presented with an impression or idea or a concept of God, if you can remember, do you remember what that was like for you or what image you had? But what image do we now have as an expression of our God? What do you now, what image do you hold in your heart? If I would ask you to close your eyes, and when I would say the word God, what comes to mind? Love?
Father.
Father. Thank you. Pardon?
Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
Okay.
Presence.
Light.
Electrical current.
Electrical current. Could we say life force? Okay. Which is energy. Mm-hmm. Yes.
The Good Shepherd.
Okay. So the Good Shepherd and embracing you. I can see that. Okay. Pardon? The Sacred Heart of Jesus. That image that we see in that it looks like a very old picture of Jesus, but it's beautiful. Yes? Pardon? Lover of your soul. Okay, now these are all concepts. What images do you see? Do you have an image of God?
Overwhelming and
inexplicable. Okay. Okay, so no one's still sitting in the lap of the old man with the long white beard and white robes. Okay. If you would ask a person here, what is their image of God? And most of the time they would say they now have no image of God or no concept of God. Does that make sense? Because we have been invited into the cloud of unknowing. And can we bear it? So our maturing concepts of God, I like to liken that to what Thomas Aquinas said in his later stages of spiritual growth. And he said, it's all straw. It's all like straw. All of his wonderful writing and guidance. So I like to ask sometimes too, we throw the word transformation around a lot. We hear a lot about transformation. So transformation in the Night of Spirit talks to us about the freedom from over-identification of roles, purifies those secret motivations and satisfactions that we've talked about, the further and deeper purification of the unconscious, the freedom from the last traces of domination of emotional programs, purification of our childhood concepts of God, and purification of our understanding of these theological virtues of faith, hope, and love, and purification of that deep-rooted selfishness that we still see at play in ourselves. Anything that you'd like to say about that? Yes. Thank you. Amazingly, when we come to Night of Spirit, we would think that we could say a lot about the Night of Spirit, but the truth of it is, we say much less. And if we, doing a workshop on this topic, when we come here and I ask people to share their experience, it moves us to silence. Because even if we have the experience of being in that place, again, remember what I said early on, we are trying to define that infinite experience with a finite mind. And so there are less and less words that we can humanly describe that place. Diminishment of the I, and that is the personal I. It doesn't mean that we are being as we know ourselves to be annihilated. And that seems to be, as I've spoken to many people, a great fear that if I progress on the journey and that I will lose my personal self. And I will not know myself anymore. But that's not so. The I of self-centeredness diminishes as the great I am looms in its place. To me, the loss of the personal I means the disadvantaged personality that replicates the false self experience. But the emergence of the true self is what stays in place. We can call that perhaps Christ consciousness. Susan? Yes.
On Contemplative Outreach Facebook page, one day they had like a yin and yang, and it said, I haven't changed. I just woke up. I think that really, I have that
printed it out and hung it on my wall in my office. I have not changed. I just woke up.
Yes.
What it feels like to me, you just keep waking up and waking up.
Sure. And that's what this journey is all about. It's and I know Father Murphy and I this morning, he did a beautiful mass, and there were just the two of us. And it was so sweet. And he has talked about to me just briefly in our brief acquaintanceship that life is such a mystery. And in his at the age where he is now in life, in the stage that is becoming more prevalent and more obvious to him. Would you like to speak to that, Father Murphy? I'd love for them to hear that.
Let me just say just a few words, because one of the things that I always had difficulty with was being born in a relationship with God. And that was a big breakthrough once we... And I think I was telling Susan that probably took place about 5 years ago. And then, but I just want to just say one thing, if I could. We are born with God, and God loves us much more than we ever could love ourselves. But we succumb now, we've turned away from God, which is what the whole notion of sin is. Now, he gives us the indwelling of the Holy Spirit, which is much, much bigger. And he assures us, if we're in the Spirit, we have nothing to worry about. And I think that's extremely important, because sometimes people can say, well, you know, the Lord is with me, we have a relationship, so I can do anything I want. You know, I can kind of go along, maybe I'll take it, maybe I'm not going to take it. There's consequences. There's consequences in all of these things. But it's always based on love. And the only way, getting back to the mystery aspect, the only way that I can allow myself to enter into that mystery is I realize that God loves me. And that everything, I think, was one of the things you said last night, Susan, everything is done very gently. In other words, sometimes we think of this process as kind of I'm going to lose everything and I won't be anything at all and so forth. The whole notion is in that mystery, as we're led by God, now we truly come into the fullness of life. And it's me that's holding back the fullness of life. So as soon as I allow myself to enter into the mystery, being led by the Holy Spirit now dwelling within us, now we come to life. You know?
Yes.
I can hear myself speaking, so I'm going to quit.
Thank you. And I will tell you that it really touched me when Father Murphy said that he really, until age 80, did not fully grasp the principle of the divine indwelling. Amazing. And I think there are many of us like that, Father Murphy. And I thank you so much for your honesty and your sharing that with us. Okay, so just kind of summarizing too, in the traditional Christian contemplative spiritual journey, there are three major stages of relationship: the purgative, the illuminative, and the unitive. Now, in the purgative, the purification from the grossest forms of egotism and selfishness, and so much of that takes place in the night of sense. The illuminative, the breaking in upon the person of greater spiritual insight and understanding that God is effecting transformation in the deepest recesses of our being. And the unitive, now that word supernatural, interesting to me, we kind of look at that word as far out. And it's not a word that I would use in presentations often or at all. But Teresa and John both use the word supernatural to try and define transcendent experience. So that supernatural experience, that supernatural or unitive, is the experience and understanding of God's impression. And at the level of night of spirit, and beyond that, God's impression upon the soul is habitual, and they have conscious recognition of that. In the union of likeness, the soul resembles Christ in all activity, and we might say that would be a stage of Christ consciousness, or where Paul says, no longer me, but Christ in me. No longer me, but Christ in me. The five phases of what we would say, what is unitive life. The dark night of the spirit would be the first stage of that, a falling away of the false self and its control. A powerful shattering of selfhood, or the personality that needs to be purified. The I of our personal ego is replaced with be still and know that great I am. Peace found. Peace is initially dry, and we have to understand that we may have an interior peace, but external trials may still be coming our way. But the peace interiorly is restful and a welcome relief from phase one. And so we know that the world isn't going to change for us. Problems exist, but we can embrace that inner peace and continues interior silence, arriving at the top of the unitive mountain. Well, that's pretty lofty. What that says to me is sometimes coming to that place, I just call it, and even in ordinary activity, ordinary life, I call it that place of still point, the point of stillness, the still point place. Does that make sense? Okay. So, yes, John of the Cross says there's a continuous flow of exterior trials, as John and Teresa both experienced, and that doesn't go away. But John, as we see from his story and his life, he made no judgment of that. And the last statements, and this comes from Father Thomas, an invitation to love. What? Okay, and I don't have a copy of your handout on the desk here, so it's not on there? Okay. I'm sorry, it is a mystery then.
Okay.
No, I'm sorry. It doesn't work. I tried. Yes, no. So Thomas tells us that toward divine love, we can't escape the worldliness, but we can acknowledge and confront it. We've talked about that. The invitation to allow God to change our motivation from selfishness to divine love is the call to transforming union. Okay? And to those on the spiritual journey, nothing happens that is not directed toward divine union if we can only say yes. And so I'd like to close the night of spirit with a reading of the unknowable again. But before I move into that, I'd like to know if there's any questions that you have about the Night of Spirit, any comments, if you would like to share any experience of that.
No, but I'd like to know the page where you're going
to... It's that 53.
That one?
That, yes. In the collected works. It's the fourth stanza of The Living Flame of Love, the last book that he wrote, the poetry. It is stanza number 4. Okay. So the Night of Spirit is a deepening of the last stages of trials of purification. in our ordinary life, in our interior life. It is different from the night of sense in that there generally are no external trials. It is moving us into the cloud of unknowing and consenting, asking us to consent to live in that unknowing. So John says it well in his last stages of life. I entered into unknowing, yet when I saw myself there without knowing where I was, I understood great things. I will not say what I felt, for I remained in unknowing, which transcended all knowledge. That perfect knowledge was of peace and holiness, held at no remove in profound solitude. It was something so secret that I was left stammering, transcending all knowledge. I was so overwhelmed, so absorbed and withdrawn, that my senses were left deprived of all their sensing, and my spirit was given an understanding while not understanding, transcending all knowledge. He who truly arrives there cuts free from himself. All that he knew before now seems worthless, and his knowledge so soars that he is left in unknowing, transcending all knowledge. The higher he ascends, the less he understands, because the cloud is dark, which lit up the night. Whoever knows this remains always in unknowing, transcending all knowledge. This knowledge in unknowing is so overwhelming that wise men dispute it, but cannot overthrow it. For their knowledge does not reach to the understanding of not understanding, transcending all knowledge. This supreme knowledge is so exalted that no power of man or learning can grasp it. He who masters himself will, with knowledge in unknowing, always be transcending. And if you should want to hear, this highest knowledge lies in the loftiest sense of the essence of God. This is a work of his mercy and love, to leave one without understanding, which transcends all knowledge. And in closing, I would just like to read a brief reading from Father Thomas in terms of the dark night, the night of spirit. He says it so well. And of course, he begins to say what transformation is. And he calls it, of course, transformation is not an experience, it's not a thing, but it is a restructuring of consciousness that perceives a new dimension to all reality. We live in a third dimensional world, and he said it is the perception of a fourth dimension. This is the work of the night of spirit, the beginning of divine union according to John of the Cross, and a further transitional stage involving a more intimate and interior purification. The night of spirit is designed to free us from the residue of the false self in the unconscious and thus to prepare us for transforming union. Those who have been led by the path of exuberant mysticism are especially susceptible to subtle temptations. They may experience psychic or spiritual gifts and become gifted teachers or charismatic leaders. But the very gifts that attract people to them and to their teachings subtly incline them toward a different kind of self-image. Precisely because of their spiritual attainment, the temptation arises to identify with the role of prophet, wonder worker, enlightened, martyr, victim, charismatic leader, are in short God's gift to humanity. So we've talked about that, and he goes on to speak about that a little bit. The spiritual journey is not a success story, but a series of diminutions of self. There are five significant fruits of the night of spirit, and the first is the freedom from the over-identification of roles, because roles are very temporary. Also, the purification of the secret satisfaction of being chosen as the recipient of God's special gifts. A second fruit is the freedom from domination of any emotion, gradually frees us from the last traces of domination by emotional swings or mood. And also, the third fruit, the purification of the God of our childhood. And no one can describe the experience of pure faith. We know only that an immense and unnameable energy is welling up inside. This immense energy may be experienced by some as impersonal, although it certainly treats us in a personal way. And, of course, a fourth fruit of the night of spirit is the purification of faith, hope, and love. Our idea of the spiritual journey and the means we should use to pursue it, perhaps our ideas of our vocation, the church, Jesus Christ, even God himself, may be shattered. This experience is reflected in the great personages of Scripture, like Job, Moses, Joseph, Mary, and Jesus himself. A fifth fruit of the night of spirit is the longing to let go of the selfishness that still lingers in us. God is not bound by our ideas, he reminds us. Sometimes the night of sense begins at once. Sometimes the night of sense and night of spirit are reversed. And sometimes, in rare cases, they may take place at the same time. If we have read widely and expect that things are going to proceed according to our understanding, God will reverse the normal order for our benefit. One way or another, we have to take the leap of trust into the unknown. Okay? And one final word. Sometime when we do this workshop, people will say, well, so what comes after this? What comes after this stage? And I say, how would I know? But if I have to say any answer at all, I think it would be what Jesus said. I and my Father are one. And Jesus' prayer is that we may be as one with them. Okay. I think we are a little bit ahead of schedule, but this is the time where we have a little time for a large group evaluation. Maybe one thing you're taking home with you today that may be of help to you in your spiritual journey. Anything that you would like to say, reiterate, or comment about the day is welcome. And then we will close with the prayer.
I found the chart that you did and the axial shifts in the critical thresholds to be very awakening for me, to help me see what those movements are and to understand that, okay, I could flow backwards and come forwards, but it helped me feel the ability to surrender some of these feelings, allow it to happen. And so then when the shifts happen again, I'm going to understand how that affects me and what to look for and what it could be someday.
Okay. Or not.
or not.
Thank you.
To do a lot more research and reading. Thank you.
Oh my gosh, yes, we could read ourselves into eternity.
Right. Love to.
I think it's a wonderful opportunity to come together and beam each other with whatever of God is shining through us. And I'm very grateful for each one of you. And you, Susan, thank you.
I'm not sure if this is appropriate, so feel free to say you missed the window. Could you please speak just a little bit to distinguishing personality and false self?
I think the best way that I could say it, and please if anyone else, if you can say it better, I certainly welcome that. You know, the personality is kind of the persona of our soul, but it is self-made. In other words, we know that the false self is made in our own image and what we contrive, whereas the true self is made in the image of God, and we are returning to that state. So, there was a second part to your question. Can you reiterate that again?
False self.
Yes.
False self compared to personality.
Okay. Well, the false self is what we have contrived in characteristics of the of our persona. We have created a false self within our personality that expresses through our personality, might be a better way of saying it.
I guess when you said that, I'm sure, have you not ever had anyone say something really complimentary about you and how wonderful you are, or something that they've seen about you that, and sometimes you think inside me, if they only really knew who I was. Yeah, and I mean, so, but your personality is what they see. But I relate that to being a false self that I'm projecting, because that's not truly.
So personality is.
But that doesn't mean it's bad. Maybe to a certain extent, manifestation of a false self.
Well, the personality is the personality, but we infuse the personality with the characteristics of the false self value system. Does that make sense? It's infused within our personality. And Maru, you can tackle this.
Your personality is what you want people to see.
Yes, but we all have a personality. Yes.
So I have a question for you. Are you talking about personality or persona?
Personality.
Okay. Well, it's interesting because Thomas and I were having a conversation about this last week. And we were going back and forth because we're reading like these three books and these different people philosophizing about the self and no self. And personality and all of that. But one of the authors, who is a neuroscientist, was talking about the self being more of an activity than an actual entity. And he was talking about the self in terms, at the point in which we have developed and meditated, but we are still relating as an individual, because we're still embodied. So he was talking about the self being, a subject of experience and an agent of action. So those two things were very interesting. But basically he was talking that the self can still be experienced in its capacity to relate individually to the environment, and also that we can still be involved in an I-making activity in as much as we are acting in the world, but without the illusion of being an entity, separate from. Was that clear? I tried to be as... So I don't know if that's helpful. For me, I think it's always been important to realize that in the healing transformation and process, God wants to heal the little individuality that he created and that he treasures. To heal those wounds of not being accepted, not being loved, not being wanted, not having enough power, you know, injustice, whatever it is that you want to talk about. And I believe that God does heal that. And then there is a process in the personality of healing. And in dropping the false self, and I was asking Thomas about this, he was talking about the false self as being the ego. But in psychology, we talk also about the persona, you know, which is what you need to relate to the world that surrounds you. You need a vehicle of relating. And hopefully that persona becomes better constructed, if you will, to convey the values of the gospel. So the persona being the vehicle, the face of the individuality. But at what point is that a false self or simply a vehicle of being a subject of experience and an agent of action?
Thank you. Thank you, Maru. Thank you. Yeah, and I think, too, if we could, you know, make it a little simpler, I think the personality, too, is simply the psychological makeup of our being. You know, it is the... And it is affected by our cultural conditioning, by so many things in our life and in our environment, and certainly culture. I hope that what Maru said, I hope these little tidbits and Maru's big tidbit help you. Okay. Anything else? Do we clearly understand the night of sense? Yeah. Yes. Yes, because I think that will be our experience on our journey. And perhaps not so the night of spirit was what John of the Cross, and he speaks volumes about the night of spirit. And of course, you can't extract everything that he's saying. We don't have the time, but I think it would wear us all out. And I know we're approaching that place where we are, our brain is bordering on overwhelm, and so we don't want to kill it. But I would really encourage you to take time just to go back and to read it, page by page, or paragraph by paragraph. I do think from our discussion today that your understanding of what John is saying will be more understandable to you by reading it now than by perhaps reading it before. So anyway, there are interpretations, many interpretations now of John's work and his writings, but I still prefer, I want to hear it from the teacher. I want to hear it from John. And the same with Teresa. Many interpretations of what she is saying are surfacing, but I want to hear it from Teresa, and then I can read all of the things that other people and their perspective. Okay? All right. I think this has ended. So I would ask Michael to close this day with prayer, if you would, please.
Let us just pause and remind ourselves that we are in God's presence, as God is present within us. Dear Lord, we thank you for this day, this opportunity to gather with our brothers and sisters in you. We thank you for all those who have made this journey to be with us and to share. Lord, we ask for safe journeys home. We ask for blessings on all those who are suffering in journeys as refugees today. And we ask your blessing on them, that we all might come together as one in your heavenly castle. Amen.
Thank you. And I want to just take one last opportunity to thank everyone who made this day possible, to thank Nestor, the coordinator of Central Florida, all of you wonderful people of Central Florida, all of you wonderful people who traveled here to be here. I want to especially thank, too, Andy and Melinda Rawls. I don't know where Melinda is right now. There she is. But the work that they have done in videotaping many presentations and today audio taping this presentation. And Melinda is reminding us that she would like to have your name tag. So thank you to all of those who made this day possible. Safe travels. God bless.